Matthew chapter 6. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Let's pray. Our gracious King, if we struggle to bring the best words that we feel you would deserve, we find it hard to know how to lay before you the praises that we owe you, the gratitude that does at times really fill our hearts. And at other times, God, we're ashamed to say that we have to remind ourselves constantly of your goodness. But even at our best, our prayers fall so short. And yet you are worthy. And you are a gentle Father, a gracious King, a faithful Redeemer. You bought us out of our slavery, and you brought us into your family. You have opened our eyes to see the ugliness of sin. You've opened our eyes to see the altogether loveliness of your Son, and conquered us, not with just an irresistible might, but with an irresistible beauty. You've shown yourself to be everything our souls could long for when we long for what's best. You've drawn us out of the darkness and into the kingdom of the Son of your love, a kingdom of light. You've given us hope and clarity. You've put our feet in a wide open place and commanded us to live, really live. So we come to you this morning, every believer here this morning, able to present themselves to you afresh, to find new mercies meeting us before our feet hit the floor, mercies that we have walked with for years, mercies that our fearful hearts would tell us that maybe they've grown tired of our company. But here they are, as if for the very first time. We come to you, God, and meet all of your infinitely perfect and immeasurable attributes. And yet in Christ, they seem to all meet us in kindness. We ask God that as the gospel is preached this morning, down the street or across the world, that your Son would be exalted and that the pride of man would be thrown in the dust, that the emptiness of sin's alluring lies and of religion's false and feeble cover would be set aside and Christ would be treasured. God, deliver us from conversions that don't change us. Deliver us from a religion of words that has no power to alter us. We pray for a mighty jarring of that self-centeredness again, and that Christ would again be seen by us as worth living for, dying for. We ask that the things that he says here about life and his kingdom, especially acts of devotion, and how they are all to be done in a way that pleases you, will you teach us, God? Not one of us has done this, but we want to do this. So we look to the one man who offered you perfect devotion. And we ask Jesus of Nazareth at the right hand of the Father, by your Spirit, bend down, take us by the hand, and show us how to live unto you. We ask it in your name, Christ. Amen. In the Sermon on the Mount, we've been looking at Christ's own explanation of what it looks like to live under his gracious rule but in a world that rejects him. In other words, we're looking still at the issue of righteousness. What does it mean to be right with God? And how does that change the way we live every day? How do we live rightly before God? In chapter 5, we looked a lot at the law of God and the Christian. In the new covenant, how do we approach the commands of God? Well, really, it's the same as the old covenant in the sense that it has always been an issue of the heart primarily, and that affects the life. So not one or the other. Obedience is a heart issue. In chapter 6, we're moving on with the theme of righteousness still, but we're applying it into two great areas of the Christian life. We could say the area of devotion, deeds of devotion, and the area of dependence, trusting God for our daily needs. So in chapter 6, whether we're looking at deeds of devotion or a life of dependence upon God, what we're really looking at is a Godward life. How do we live our lives in the awareness that God is aware of us? And how do we, in our heart, do all things for love of God? Now, chapter 6, verse 1 gives you the general principle. And you remember back in chapter 5, verse 17 through verse 20 gave you a general principle about the law, followed by 6 examples. In chapter 6, we have a general principle followed by 3 examples. The principle is found in verse 1. Beware. All right, this is something that all religious people are tempted toward. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. And what follows then in verse 2 through verse 18 are 3 examples of how to apply this. So the examples have a double purpose. Like all good teaching, the examples are driving home the main point. Okay, so don't come to this passage and think the 3 things that are important in religion are giving, praying, and fasting. And because that's all that Christ talks about, but that's not the case. Giving, praying, and fasting are examples that Christ chooses. I think in part because these are things in every religion, these are things that are popular options for using God and making religion all about you. I was reading an older author, A.W. Pink. Perhaps you're familiar with Pink. A.W. Pink noted in his comments on this passage that even Islam in the Quran emphasizes these 3 things as essential aspects of devotion. And the Quran teaches that prayer gets a person halfway to heaven. And fasting brings you up to the gate. But giving to the poor gains you entrance. Now, it would be very easy to say, well, how nonsensical. Prayer doesn't get you halfway to heaven. And fasting the rest of the way. And then giving to poor people gets you in the gate. I mean, who would think that? But this is the natural religion of every one of you. This is my natural religion. This is the best that religion offers you. I don't care what part of the world you're in or what book you're using, even if, like the Jews, you're using the book that the living God gave you. Giving, praying, fasting, deeds of devotion are custom made when we approach them in the wrong way, as things that we think would somehow bribe God to help pay off our debts, or things that we can use to fix ourselves, to scrub ourselves up, to make us clean. They were very popular in Jesus' day, and they're still popular in our day in some fashion. So Christ pulls out 3 common elements in religion and points out that in his kingdom, living before his face, even acts of devotion, like giving and praying and fasting, must be from the heart a Godward thing if they're to have any value. Now, Another thing I think that Christ's use of these three examples gives, another importance about that, is it does remind us that in the new covenant, the finished work of Christ on the cross, the sending of the Spirit in that fullness at Pentecost, does not in any way make giving to the poor or praying or fasting inappropriate. In fact, we could say this, that there is something about the new covenant fullness that makes giving and praying and fasting things that are enduringly appropriate for every citizen of Christ's kingdom. Well, let's look at the first one this morning, the issue of giving. How do the subjects of Jesus Christ, the most generous of kings, how do they go about giving so that the king himself might be pleased? How do we do it for his eyes? Now, it might be strange to us that of the three things, he begins with giving. I find that a little strange at first. If I were writing the passage, I probably would put something like prayer first. So these are acts of devotion. All right, so number one, prayer. And then, of course, number two, fasting. And then, at the end of the list of devotion, oh, well, and also giving, which to us might seem like a very man-oriented, people-oriented, humanitarian kind of thing. But in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, giving is as much a Godward thing as it is a manward thing. And giving has to be done with the right heart, just like praying. And perhaps we haven't thought of it that way. I mean, we know that when we come to pray together, and, you know, especially you feel it, don't you? When you're in a corporate prayer meeting, you go to voice a prayer and you think, is my heart right? Am I doing this for the right motives? Am I doing this to be heard by other people or by God? So there, you know, there are those heart struggles that we feel that are natural to us. But probably giving to needy people, whether it's a paycheck, you know, or food or your time and your help, we probably don't agonize as much over that. You know, as you're handing someone a gift, you probably aren't agonizing over, oh, am I doing this with the right motive? Will it be acceptable? What will people think? Am I doing it for what people think? But giving is a Godward activity. And so Christ starts there. I also think that of the three, giving is probably the most difficult to do in a Godward way, because it just is natural for us in our giving to think only on the horizontal, you know. Well, I'm really just focused on people and maybe what people would think of me. And I forget that there is a vertical aspect of it. Well, the Greek word here that Christ uses for giving, alms, is a Greek word that means to give to those who are needy. In other words, it's an act of mercy or pity. So that's different. I mean, there are the kind of gifts. You remember in chapter 5, he mentioned, you know, if you give to people that can give back to you, how are you any different than a lost person? You know, if you invite people over to your house and feed them supper, and they'll invite you back, and it's pleasant. Well, there's nothing wrong with that, but that really isn't anything unusual. Even the world does that. This is not giving a gift to a friend just because, you know, you like them. It is giving to a person who is needy because of their sin. They've become needy because of living in a world that is sinful and it impacts us all. They've become needy. It is mercy and pity that's being shown here. Now, when we think of this, I want us to expand the idea far beyond money. I think we can appropriately include meeting the need of the needy people around you in any way that that need is manifested. So obviously we do that in light of the way that God gives, you know, so we want to be discriminating. We want a biblical view of love to be the way that we exercise that. For example, you remember that Paul says to the Thessalonians, if a man doesn't work, he's not to eat. So if you find a guy that's lazy and says, I just don't want to go to work, don't bring him a plate at night and feed him. So we're not talking about just this indiscriminate handouts, not paying attention to how it would affect people. Love is the guide. Scripture spells that out. But I don't want to talk about that because I don't think that that's our great problem. You know, the problem with Christ Church is not that we are so amazingly generous, we are bankrupting all of our families by just giving handouts indiscriminately. The problem is what J.C. Ryle in the 1800s said to his church. We are often guilty of an evangelical stinginess. And we don't want to be that way. We want to follow Christ. Let's expand our idea of giving. Whatever is needed to meet the need to show pity and mercy and kindness to the needy person, that's included in this idea of giving. So it may very well be money, but it also might be things. It also might be food. It might be friendship. It might be your time, your efforts, your labor, your prayers, your counsel. I find that it's much more expensive to give of myself than it is to give of the stuff that God has let me have. It's easier to give money than to give energy of thought. You know what I mean? Where you with your very limited resources and time, you devote part of that to thinking, how can I be a real help to a person? I find that it's very costly to give involvement of my heart, where it's very easy just to give a thing. So sharing anything that God has given you with the needy, as it would be appropriate, all areas of generosity, all areas of service. If we go back through the Bible, we find that this is mentioned from the beginning to the end. All right, I'm going to read you just a selection of verses from the Old Testament and one from the New Testament. I wonder if you know how clearly God has commanded his people to be givers. And it doesn't matter that we are in a nation that, you know, because of Christian influence, we do have a system that's set up to help people who are needy. But that doesn't relieve us of the responsibility. So let me give you just a few of these. Deuteronomy 15, verse 7 and 8, and then verse 11. If there is a poor man with you, one of your brothers, in any of your towns, in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart. Anybody hardened their heart? It's easy to harden your heart, isn't it? You look at the way that a government gives, and you react against that. You say, that's foolish. I mean, you're hurting people. They are sometimes, and then you get hard. Ever hardened your heart because the person you're giving to comes back to you so frequently, and you think, you've had enough. I've helped enough. So he says, do not harden your heart, nor close your hand from your poor brother, but you shall freely open your hand to him and shall generously lend him sufficient for his need in whatever he lacks. Goes on to say this, for the poor will never cease to be in the land. All right, you remember the phrase in the New Testament, you always have the poor with you. That's a quote from this passage. Listen to the logic. You're always going to have poor people in this world. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall freely open your hand to your brother, to your needy, and to your poor in the land. That is the exact opposite of what we would naturally do. We would say, come on, God, poor people are going to always be here. It's not like you can fix poverty. So why even relieve the need of the person next to me? Leviticus 25, verse 35. He adds another element. He says, now, in the case of a countryman of yours, okay, a Jew, becomes poor and his means with regard to you, what he owes you, falter. So someone owes you and they can't pay. You are to sustain him. Not just don't take their house from them, don't take their stuff from them, sustain them. You are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner that he may live with you. All right? Find him a room in your house. Help him. Proverbs 19, God takes this personally. Listen to this. One who is gracious to a poor man lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his good deed. Do you remember the passage in Matthew 25 where Christ gives a picture of the end of time and the judgment? And Christ makes statements to believers and says, when I was sick, you visited me. When I was in prison, when I was needy and poor, you fed me, you clothed me. Do you remember that? And the response of the people was, Jesus, when were you ever this way and we treated you like that? And he said, when you did it to the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. Wonderful explanation of that proverb. He who gives to the poor lends to God. Proverbs 28, there's promises and curses. He who gives to the poor will never lack, but he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. Psalm 41, verse 1, blessed is the one who considers the poor. In the day of trouble, the Lord will deliver him. 1 John in the New Testament, chapter 3, listen to these words. Verse 16, we know love by this, that he, Christ, laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for our brethren. All right, so pretty clear statement. But whoever has the world's goods and sees his brother in need and closes his heart against him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth. So, before we look any further, that's the command of your God. If you're a Christian, no other option. Do not let the world conform you in the matter of your generosity. Two ways that I feel that constantly, so maybe you do as well. There is, of course, the enticing, alluring greed of the world, where the world puts on my phone and my computer 5,000 things a month that I desperately need to be happy. I didn't even know. Then I see them and I agree. My whole family says that I am the biggest sucker for advertisement. I admit it. Do not follow the world in its lie that the accumulation of more will make us happy. That's hard, but we're not to follow the world there. The other way is what I mentioned before. Do not react to the world when it does give. Think of, you know, kind of governmental spending. When it does give in ways that are not wise, do not let your heart say, well, I'm not going to give, because look at how foolish giving is done in our era, in our generation. So what does the Christian do? Well, you follow the pattern of Christ and you follow the words of Christ. So here are the words of Christ. In verse 2 and following, the simple principle of doing your deeds of kindness for the eyes of God is given in the example of giving. So in a sense, you could just sum it up like this. When your hand is handing someone an envelope with some money because you know they're needy, and you're giving something to someone that's down and out, while your hand is stretching out, what is your heart thinking? We have two illustrations here that are so simple, the pictures so simple, that you can't possibly miss them. All right, first picture. Don't give with loud trumpets. Second picture. Do give with blind, ignorant left hands. All right, sounds strange to us? Look at the passage again in verses 2 and following. The first picture. Don't be like the hypocrites and send a person ahead of you with a trumpet blowing every time you go to do something kind for someone. Anybody ever done that? Ken? Mike Nolly ever had a trumpet in front of you? You ever done that? Some commentators say that this is hyperbole. I mean, nobody ever did that. Others, and I would agree with others, that probably it was done. In Christ's day, if you were going to go and give to, you know, to people who are needy, they would gather at the temple. That would be the place for the beggar to show up. And at a certain time of day, But it's not like, you know, with us where you have internet and your phone reminds you, hey, it's 2 o'clock Friday, so now's the time to be getting a handout. And so one of the ways they would do is they would have a trumpeter blow a trumpet in front of the temple, and that would let the poor people know that giving is about to start. And so if you're needy, you need to come. But imagine that you just adjust that a little bit, okay? So that's reasonable, but then you adjust it a little, and you hire your own trumpeter. And your own trumpeter goes in front of you. And if anyone says anything to you about self-advertisement, all you have to say is, oh, no, it's not for me. It's so people can know. I don't want anybody to miss out. I've saved up. I have things to give. It can sound so reasonable to hire a trumpeter. Have you ever had little trumpets? You know, muted trumpets. I don't know much about band and trumpets, but I do know that sometimes in band, a trumpeter, others, they have that little thing, they'll stick right in the cone of the trumpet and it mutes it, so it quiets it. Do you have a muted trumpet? Anybody ever actually played a muted trumpet? Come on, confess. We have one. Anybody? Randy, you never play trumpet? Trombone, Randy. All right. Muted trumpets. You say, I would never have a trumpet. Can you imagine coming to church and before you went to put money in the offering box, you had a trumpeter walk in and blare a trumpet in the room? Can you imagine how shocking that would be? Do you have a little trumpet? Do you have a muted trumpet? How do we apply that to ourselves today? Do you do things so that other people will notice? Do you use your kindnesses as a self-advertisement for other people so that they will think of you in a certain way? You want to be thought of as a person that really loves God. You want to be thought of as a person that cares enough to give, to serve, to sacrifice. Have you ever had a trumpet with you while you were mowing someone's lawn in the church or the church? I've actually never seen anybody with a trumpet on a lawnmower, but it happens. Have you ever had a trumpet when you put money in the box? Have you ever had a trumpet when you were cooking in your kitchen to bring food to someone in the church who's been sick? Have you ever had a trumpet when you picked up a pen and wrote a letter? Tiny trumpets. It is so easy to want to be known as a godly person. So it will require special care not to let it slip all that you're doing for people. Do not use acts of service and kindness and generosity for your identity. I know nobody here would think you're earning salvation and you're getting in the gate. Like the Quran might say, but you might be fashioning a persona, an image, an identity, so that people say about you, you know, that person's so kind, they would do anything for you. They would give you the shirt off their back. And there's something really enticing about using church and Christianity to earn yourself an identity. You must be willing to give, forgetting people. Little trumpets, muted trumpets. Have you ever told people how God has really blessed you since you've started to give more and trusted Him with your finances? Have you ever let it slip how often you quietly serve and nobody notices? Do you have, Charles Spurgeon said, It is a strange scene to see a Christian with a trumpet in one hand and a dollar in the other hand giving it into the church plate. That would be strange. It is just as strange for us to be serving the Lord in the kingdom of Christ, generously giving of ourselves to other people with our iPhone taking a selfie. And I don't mean that metaphorically. because of social media, you can do something, and before you get home from doing a kind thing, you've posted what a joy it was to be able to serve this great, super wonderful friend that's better than everything. You can let people know how hard you work, what a great mom you are, how little you sleep, but how happy you are still in Jesus. There are ways to blow our trumpet, and they're so common now that self-advertisement is no longer even embarrassing. I was reading Lloyd Jones on the passage, and in the 1940s and 50s, Lloyd Jones said, of course, we wouldn't blow a trumpet because we all feel that self-advertisement is distasteful. I mean, when you see someone blowing their own horn, telling everybody all that they've done, it bothers us. We think, what he said, you know, how embarrassed we are for that person. I think, what world does he live in? Self-advertisement is the way. Churches can do this. We can be involved in acts of kindness, not for love of God or the good of souls, but as a public relations stunt. Quite popular. The question is always this: whose eyes are watching you give? Is this a Godward thing? Now, let me give you a couple of warnings. Jesus says right off, don't be like this. Don't be like the hypocrite. Well, we know what a hypocrite is. But in Jesus' day, it was so clear. The Greeks put on theater productions and they would wear a mask. And the Greek word for masking yourself was hypocrite. So Jesus is saying, don't let your acts of kindness and service and generosity, don't let them be, in a sense, you putting on a mask to assume a different identity. So that you want to assume a different identity. You want people in the audience to see you as different than you really are. I'm not John. I'm super Christian. I'm wonderful, gracious, generous, servant-hearted John, not selfish John, the real John. So I put a mask on. Do not be the hypocrite. Second, you do understand that if you give in a way that Christ warns you not to give, for the eyes of men, so that they notice you, so that you can be satisfied with yourself, so they can think you're a wonderful person, you are turning a gift into a purchase. You are buying, bribing people. You're buying a good reputation. It turns helping into using. It's not really about the needy person. It's really about us. And they are useful because as we give to them, we feel great about us. Another warning is right here in the passage when Jesus says, if you do this for the eyes of men, you have received all the reward that you will receive. And in the Greek, they used a phrase that's pretty clear to us, paid in full. So in that day, just like in our day, if a person had a debt, so you bought something and you paid part down on it, and so there would be a record of that. There would be, you know, a piece of paper with the contract. And every time you came and paid on it, a little more would be put. And when it was paid off, then, of course, they would write what we would write, paid in full. And that's the Greek words that Christ is using here. If you do this so that people can see what a wonderful Christian you are, your generosity and your sacrificial service have been paid in full. You got the fickle, shallow approval of humanity. But do not expect God to reward it at all. God doesn't even notice it. It wasn't offered to him. So why would he pay you for it? What a terrible thing to spend an entire life in religion. And at the end, to stand before God and you pull out this giant, you know, roll of paper, this giant book of this ledger that you've been keeping. And you say, God, here I did this. Here I did this. Here I gave this. I sacrificed this. And God to look at it and say, I'm sorry. Do you not see the front cover? And you look at the front cover and you're shocked. Paid in full. It's already written on it. So easy to do, especially with social media. as we're able to advertise ourselves and how godly we are and how sacrificial our church is. And we advertise ourselves, and immediately you are paid in full. Someone puts a comment on there. You're the greatest thing ever. I am shocked, personally, that you believe any of that. That you believe you're the greatest person that they just said you were. Aren't you embarrassed when they write that junk? I'm serious. Like they say, to my best, greatest friend, best person ever, most godly person, this angel that is there for me. I think, who are you talking about? It's not me. So this kind of empty praise of humanity, it's worthless. And it's fickle. All you have to do is offend the person, and suddenly the commenter on your Facebook page has unfriended you, and now you have nothing. Christ warns, if you do this for what people will think, if you're fashioning an identity, if you're wanting approval, then ultimately you have gotten everything you're ever going to get. So trumpets, do not let trumpets go along with you, even little ones, when you are generous. Second, blinded, ignorant left hands. That's the second picture. Christ goes further. Not just don't blow the trumpet. Don't call attention to yourself. Forget about what other people are thinking. Don't do it for their eyes. Here's the more difficult one. Don't even do it for your own eyes. Do not keep a record, a ledger. Do not keep an account of all that you're doing in the kingdom for other people. Be self-forgetful. Forget people. Forget yourself. So the picture is quite striking, isn't it? You go to put money in the offering plate or in the box, or you go to do something with your right hand. Most of us are right-handed, so we're active with the right hand. As you put that in, you say, oh, wait, stop. Let me do something here. You get your left hand and put it down in the pocket. You turn where you can't see, put it in. I mean, is that what Christ is talking about? That would be a bit ludicrous. But I want you to understand that the heart that he's talking about is much more radical than you finding a way to hide your left hand. Do not let yourself pay attention to how generous you are and how sacrificial you've been. And do not keep a record of it. I think one of the marks of us doing this correctly is when you find a person who, for love of God, not for the praise of men, but for the pleasure of God, and not for my own smug self-satisfaction, you give and you work and you labor. And years later, people sometimes come to you and say, do you remember when you did this? It was such a help to me. I can never pay you back for that. And you say, sorry, I don't even remember doing that. Now, some people just have bad memories. I have a bad memory, so that doesn't mean I'm righteous. But I wish we had righteously bad memories where people would say, you were so helpful. And we think, oh yeah, well, I kind of forgot I did that, because your focus was always on God. Loving God, flowing out into doing deeds of mercy and pity, generous giving of ourselves and our things to people, we're self-forgetful. Blind hands that can't see. Blind left hands. Now, how can you do that? Christ gives us a great motivation, all right? And the motivation is simple. There's a reward. So you can either have the reward of man's empty praise, or you can have the reward of God's approval. But you can only have one of them, so you have to pick. Are we talking about going backward into a self-centered mercenary spirit? Like, okay, I don't want to lose my reward. I mean, I've had people say this to me before. Nobody in the church here. But I remember people, like growing up in church, people would do something, and if you saw them do something nice, they'd say, oh no, I lost my reward. You're like, I'm sorry, I didn't know, I didn't mean it, you know? I mean, is that what God's talking about? We talked about this last week, but let me just apply it to this. In our self-forgetful giving, being preoccupied with pleasing our King who has given us everything, and being kind to the needy, You can afford to be self-forgetful and not keep a record because Christ keeps the record and he never forgets. And the lie that we feel that secret small acts of kindness done for love of God to those people around us, I mean, is it a waste? I mean, did it even help anybody? Did anyone even notice? Even the person I was giving to, did it even help them? And you can believe the lie that this is a worthless effort, that there's no real value in giving of yourself and your time and your heart and your money. But the lie is exposed by Christ's statement. God will see what's done in secret, and God will reward you. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Weight of Glory, talks about this passage. And Lewis gives his explanation. And I think there's some merit to it, so I'm going to shoot it to you in a short version. Lewis said, think of two different types of rewards for something you do. There are rewards that are fundamentally connected. They naturally are connected or related to what you're doing. Okay? So here's an example. You practice piano all your life. And what's the reward? Well, what naturally is connected to that is that you become a good piano player. And the reward is the ability to play a piano. Now, Lewis said, here's an example of an award that's not naturally related. So it's an unrelated award. He's not saying this is bad. He's just saying it's a different type. You practice all your life piano. You go to a contest. You enter a contest. You win the piano contest. And you get a $100 check. The $100 check is a reward. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's not essentially linked with the activity like becoming a piano player is. He gives another illustration. Imagine a girl that doesn't really love a guy, but he has a great job, an enormous bank account, and he's very respected in the small town. So she marries him for his position and his money. And the reward she gets is she gets a bank account to spend. Now that's, he says, that's not a connected thing. It's not naturally connected. He said, think of this instead. A girl and a guy love each other, and they come to the place where they are ready to mutually commit themselves to each other and to nobody else for the rest of their life. And they get married, and the reward is a life of friendship together. It's connected. It's related to it. Then Lewis comes back to this passage and says, we're not talking about, now we could say it in our modern language, we're not talking about the prosperity gospel. If you give God $10, the next thing you know, $100 showed up in your bank account. God may do that for you. But if that's your view of the passage, you're mistaken. But think of it this way. As you secretly, self-forgetfully, are able to give of yourself to please the king, to show love to your neighbor, one of the rewards is that you get to be a part of God being kind to others. And there's a great joy in that. And there's a happiness in knowing that I did this for the God I love and who has loved me. Now, I'm not saying that's all the rewards there are, because we mentioned just one verse that talked about promises. What will happen if, what happens to the person who does take care of the poor? And it talks about how God will treat them. So I think there's more rewards than that. But that's a great reward. Think, let me give you one more illustration. Imagine that you have some extra money, okay? Hard for some of you to imagine. You've got extra money. Business has been really good this year. And you're looking for places to give, to be, you know, benevolent. And there's a hospital, and they have a list of children, you know, that are very, very sick and cannot afford the treatments. And so you give. Now, one award or reward for that kind of behavior is you could get your name on a plaque if you give a whole lot. Or you could get your name on a brick underneath the big plaque if you gave some. But is that the reward you're looking for? The reward that we would feel is really connected with that, related to that, would be we give sacrificially, and we get to see the kid leave the hospital after the treatment healthy. And we think that's enough reward. To be a part of the kingdom of Christ, bringing kindness to needy people and loving the king is a reward, even if it's not the only reward. Let me give you one last motivator and then we'll close. When we think about any of these commands in the Sermon on the Mount, what do? Go back and connect them with the entrance to the sermon, the Beatitudes. You, Christian, only talking to you, you were a beggar. You were dying. You were starving. You were aching. You were far from God. You were under His righteous anger. You were obnoxious to Him. You were exiled. You were His helpless, dying enemy. And you preferred it that way. And God sought you. And Christ became poor, Paul says to the Corinthians, so that you could be made rich. Think about it. Humanity is like a city that once was beautiful. Adam and Eve in the garden, made for God to dwell in. And now we're just a ruins and we're filled with every foul thing that the earth has. And Christ came to you as a complete ruin and didn't just clean you up and rebuild, but did something so much better in your life. Made you part of the everlasting Jerusalem, a city, a people pictured as a city that God dwells in. You were robbed by sin's lies that you believed, and Christ comes and brings and restores what was stolen from you and gives you so much more. You were exiled. Christ comes and washes you and brings forgiveness, bringing you near to God, adopting you into His family. We were the people that sat in darkness, who also were the people that saw a great light. And then Paul says, you didn't just see a great light. God brought you from a kingdom of darkness into a kingdom of light. And then later he says, he didn't just do that. He made you children of light. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 4, you were dead in your sins and your trespasses, just like everyone else. But God, because of his great mercy and the love with which he loved us, he raised us from that spiritual death. He united us to Christ. He seats us with Christ in the heavenly places. And then Paul says that most amazing statement in Ephesians 2, verse 7, so that forever and ever, ages without end, you will be an expression of God's infinite kindness. You will be the living mirror of kindness. And all of these are given to the believer through the poverty of Jesus Christ. Can you not wake up, read first few verses of chapter 6 in Matthew and say, now I can do that. I can forget myself. I can forget other people and what they think of me. And I can do it just for the eyes of my God. I can give. So many opportunities all around us. If you will remind yourself of the extraordinary generosity of Christ and then ask God, show me needs. He will. And your reward will be to be allowed to live with the King every day and to carry his generosity to the people around you. And not only they, but the King is pleased.